Coming up on TechNation, finally, we're going to explain blockchain and how it's different from Bitcoin. Shadan Guran, the president of Global Blockchain Technologies, also tells us about a new system to convert from one cryptocurrency to another, just like we do when we wire money internationally. Then on TechNation Health, a new technology aims to make a range of existing medications more effective. The first targets? Osteoarthritis and liver cancer. And chief correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft explores how global tech firms are jumping into healthcare. All this coming up on this week's TechNation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Nobody argues that their baby shouldn't have a birth certificate. Well, okay, some people do, but the hassle of not having one in today's world is generally unworkable. Want to prove your citizenship? Enter school. Get a passport. Government-issued birth certificates have been accepted for decades, although baptismal certificates were once more frequently used. And then there was the lugging in of the family Bible. In pointing to each baby's name and birth date, carefully written inside the front cover. When people didn't move around much and the technology didn't exist, this worked just fine. Something similar happened with Social Security numbers. When President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Social Security Act into law in 1935, the concept was to track people based on who would benefit. And thus my grandfather and grandmother shared a single Social Security number. You see, he worked at a job, and she was a housewife. Just seemed right to the designers of the system. Both of them would be benefiting from the contributions that my grandfather made as part of his employment. The idea of registering every newborn baby? I would venture to say they would find it laughable. In my generation, you didn't get a Social Security number until you applied for your first official non-cash job or you went to college. Many of us, myself included, made up a Social Security number on a form or two just to keep the process rolling. If you didn't have one, you had to apply in person and wait. And if you did have one, you'd have to find your card and then write it down. You didn't use it very much because it said very clearly, right on the card, not to be used for identification purposes. Pretty funny, since the point of the number was identification purposes, but you get the drift. Don't flash it around as an essential source of identification. When my firstborn came along, a generous grandparent with a career as a stockbroker thought the lad should start out life with some stock of his own. So we had to get him a Social Security number. And how did we do it? I held up the baby and my husband took a photo. We got the film developed and we sent it into the Social Security office. I mean, really? A bald, nondescript baby? And I have to be in the picture, or so I was told? Well, he's used it ever since, and no doubt it is ensconced in any number of databases. Today, some 90% of U.S. parents obtain a Social Security number for their baby at birth. And it's a regular part of the standard birth registration process. Social Security calls this EAB, which stands for Enumeration at Birth. At least they got that part right. It's enumeration. They're assigning your baby a number. And no matter how you might feel about it, it's part of the modern world. While 9 out of 10 American babies will likely think of it as the heir. It's just there. But before you worry about it, if history and the arc of technology bear out, the current state of things is only a blip on the screen. You see, when it comes to biotech, there's DNA. And when a baby pops out, well, heck, There's his or her DNA right there, the ultimate identifier. In the future, the idea of being assigned a number to track you will seem incredibly archaic. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, we'll do what I've been threatening to do for a while, explain blockchain, Bitcoin, and what it means to banking as we know it. We'll hear from Shadan Guran, the president of Global Blockchain Technologies. Then on Tech Nation Health, a better technology to deliver the right dose of a medication to the right place at the right time. TLC Bio is starting with osteoarthritis and liver cancer. Given the rise of so-called cryptocurrencies, such as Bitcoin, and the emergence of its underlying technology, known as blockchain, it's become important for everyone to have a rudimentary understanding of what they are and what it means. I asked Shadan Guran, the president of Global Blockchain Technologies, to start with the technology of blockchain itself. What is it?
Blockchain is essentially more a database, a highly replicated database that anybody can write to without having to trust anybody else. So, yeah, it's a database you can read and write to anybody, and that's really the benefit of it.
The word you used was replicated, and I like that. That is part of why it's trustworthy. Let's say I write some data, like some important data for my life, and I write it to the database. A normal database just has one copy of it, and we've all written over things we didn't want to. But in this case, in the blockchain, you write it once, and it's copied and replicated thousands of times so that anybody goes after that initial record, we know exactly what it is because it's been replicated.
Exactly. It's being replicated, and it's being replicated all over the globe. So you have some person in China, you have some person in London that will have an exact copy of that database, and they can't manipulate it or change it because you're the one that signed your entry into it, and nobody else can sign it because of the magic of cryptography. That's the real benefit of it. I mean, the security comes from the replication and the fact that your identity is so strong on it.
Now, there's a number of people who can hearken back to the days of Napster. And this was years ago, 20 years ago now, amazingly, in which we didn't have iTunes. You couldn't just go out and find some music out there and download it onto anything. But everybody wanted to have music, especially the kids. And people had started to have PCs and the internet. And so they would have, if you had a song on your PC, you'd just keep connecting to the internet, and somebody, it would be on a list in Napster, and somebody would come and share it. They'd take it down. You wanted somebody else's music. You wouldn't know who you were copying from. It was all over the world because people wanted to do it. And so they shared. We haven't had to do that lately because of some changes in the technology, but there was a real value to being able to download other trusted pieces of information. In this case, for storage for and safekeeping for another time.
Exactly. And this really builds on that technology. So with Napster, you could download videos and movies and, you know, music and whatnot from anybody. But you really didn't know who was providing this. Here you can actually build systems where you know who you're getting it from. It's very secure and there's provenance. You know who has the rights to it. You can have programs that can decide, yeah, this person really has a right to it, for example. Ownership can be passed on and whatnot. And you still benefit from the, you know, highly distributed nature of it. And anybody being able to put content on it yet in a manageable way and in a way that's fully transparent and can be really tracked, which is important.
It's extremely important. And I think what's important to understand about Napster is because people wanted to participate, you were able to sign up everybody. But there was the underlying technology of how you share all that, how all of those things happen. Now, you know, 2 decades have passed, and we've been working on another technology, blockchain, which enable you to write things with your signature and can replicate it all over the world. There are many, many more devices to store it on, many more people who are participating. And it says, gee, there could be a whole lot of apps on top of it, a whole lot of applications. First, we have to get this basic application out there.
Well, I mean, look at something like YouTube, for example, or any web application and any platform. It's really just a database with a front end to it. Now, if you say that the database isn't owned by one company, but it can be replicated by anybody, absolutely anybody in the world, you can actually build a YouTube that's owned by the whole network and that, you know, people can write to and has all the benefits that a YouTube has. And this is a very big deal. Let's look at email, for example. Email, you have many providers. You have Gmail, you have Yahoo, you have Hotmail or Outlook. The same thing can be built with blockchain technologies to make YouTube a similar type of network where you have many, many providers who can speak to each other. They all write to the same database. They all read from the same database. And it's then not owned by YouTube. So you could, for example, have, you know, all the TV networks of the past decide to create a TV portal that they all control together, and they can all upload to, they can all download to. You don't have this one company who kind of acts as a gatekeeper for everybody else. And I think that's a real problem in technology today. We're seeing that with Google's and the Amazons and Facebook's of the world, where we can actually decentralize them and turn the real value into the content producers and not so much the gatekeepers.
Right. And to that point, Facebook's and Google's and Yahoo's, they got the data. They're going to let you have it.
Yeah.
If you turn around and say something not totally like Wikipedia, but the whole idea there can be many different pieces of information out there that can be shared, if you deposit it and you can control then what it says and who has access to it all over the world, many kinds of databases can be spread with access to many people.
Absolutely.
I've heard of before.
Absolutely. So what you do is say everybody owns the data, but that doesn't include the actual media content. You could still have that be a paid service by, like, for example, the TV networks and
everyone's
and
invited.
The producers. Exactly. But having a bunch of people, a bunch of competing players within an industry is much more beneficial than having one gatekeeper, you know, one monopoly essentially that controls everything.
And I think what's important is that the technology itself enables it. We don't have to have a government policy and regulation that says, you're too big, like IBM, we're going to break you up. No, the technology enables this distributed structure right from the start.
Absolutely. So what we say is, you know, you all have the same right to the data as far as, you know, users and connections and all of that. And this actually, you know, look at a Google, for example. Before YouTube and controlling portals, this was their business model. The internet already was decentralized, and their business model was to build great technology to be able to index such a system. So they're providing real value more than being a gatekeeper. This is about going back to that world where you're actually offering something of real value in being able to search for content, as opposed to just saying, you know what, I have a database, I have control to it, nobody else does, so you have to play by my rules, really.
Now, the blockchain technology is this, we've just described it, it's a platform, and we have applications that use it to become real, if you will. One that has hit the press again and again is Bitcoin. It's often mentioned in the same sentence. It's just layered on top. It's an application that uses it. Now, what is Bitcoin?
Bitcoin is a community currency. It's a currency that, you know, a group of people have decided to accept and use and speculate on and trade with. And it is built on blockchain technologies. It's actually how blockchain technologies were created, was for the purpose of Bitcoin, really. Because if you look at it, transferring money today electronically is just a database again. You have a bunch of databases by central banks that, you know, transfer balances from one account to another on a ledger. And that's what blockchains do. They take that database out of the control of one party, say anybody can run a copy of this database, And we for sure know that nobody can cheat it because, again, the identities are very strong on it. They're all cryptographic identities. If you hold the key, you're the only one that can make an entry on your behalf.
Now, if we go back to before computers, banks had ledgers. They had the double entry book system. And you would go into a bank. I actually went into one in Central America, which was kind of off the grid. And I wanted to get some money with my credit card and realized I needed to do something else to get the money. They literally had the old-fashioned big ledger books.
Right.
And it's like, great, we can exchange your money here. And they made this entry here, and they made the entry here, and there was someone behind them watching it. And it was like, this is what banks were like.
Exactly.
Years ago.
Yeah.
And the principle of those ledgers, what goes into them, hasn't changed today at your very own bank.
Not at all, yeah. And it's the same thing. It's just now the ledger is a computer database.
That's right. Yeah. And you know what it's like. You go up to the ATM machine and you insert a check you got, for instance, and then you look at the balance on your cell phone and, holy moly, you know, it's already registered. It's been registered with checks and balances and all of the things that go into it. It's all very simple, and it's at your bank.
Yeah.
So if you're talking about exchanging anything, it can be registered in ledgers. And those ledgers in the blockchain mode, if they're replicated everywhere, there's your safety. You can only change it, and they're replicated anywhere. Anybody goes up and changes it, you know, one of them, it doesn't matter, the others will out, if you will.
Absolutely. You have it exactly how it is. And, you know, so Bitcoin is an application of using blockchain technologies for money. It's a ledger in a database. And there's going to be more applications coming along. As I said, a decentralized YouTube where everything is replicated and anybody can write to it and read to it while maintaining, you know, the integrity of the database and, you know, without people being able to, fraudulently change an entry and whatnot. It can apply to Uber. It can apply to any business because that's what almost every application is today. It's just the database that you read and write to, essentially. That's what computer programs are.
Now, Bitcoin is just one of the cryptocurrencies.
Yeah.
There are lots of them.
There's lots of them, and I think this is how the world is moving. You're going to have a lot of cryptocurrencies, and you're going to have a lot of currencies in general. These technologies enable a municipality, for example, to easily issue its own cryptocurrency, its own currency, essentially, for raising money for projects within the municipality, for example. I think it's becoming evident that the world is moving towards many currencies again. You know, for a long time, we're thinking that it's all coming into one currency or a few currencies, but this isn't really working out politically and you know, from a geopolitical position, it's not really how things are going to progress. Before, mobile technologies, not even so much blockchain technologies, it wasn't possible to have many different currencies because you couldn't put them in your pocket, you couldn't put them in a cash register. But now it's all on your phone. You can have 1,000 currencies on your phone. You could have 1,000 currencies in a cash register that's a point of sale system. And the methods for them to automatically negotiate and convert and all of that is actually very easy and can be all put under the hood. So you're going to have many, many things in the future that look like currencies. And blockchains really help that model a lot, actually.
Now, I keep trying to think of examples that are currencies in effect, but not money per se. And I think a great example is the farm cooperative for products. And if you go through in the Midwest and you're out in the middle of farm country by the railroad, you'll see these big silos. And the whole idea is you go and you put your grain in the silo, a central storage area, and you get a chit that says you've got this many bushels or however, wherever they're measuring it.
Yeah.
Well, each bushel, in a sense, could be something in your silo currency.
100%.
And it could be, and this, the whole idea that you write that receipt on a blockchain means nobody can mess around with that receipt.
Nobody can mess around with it. It's actually even more secure than a central banking system. And you could transact that, you could transfer it to somebody else. Any kind of asset can be represented on a blockchain ledger. Stocks, bonds, these co-op tokens, as I said, a municipality token, anything you can name of can be put on it. And you instantly benefit from the security and the much more efficient settlement of it. Because now you have thousands of computers together working and verifying that transaction actually happened. instead of a small team of, you know, auditors who would do it in an office. So it's a big benefit.
Exactly. It's that simple, and you can prove it. You can prove it. And you use the word token, and I think that's good in that, well, while you're at the silo, it's bushels.
Yeah.
And when you were, you know, contributing something else that you wanted a receipt for or something you wanted to buy, it could be anything. It could have a weight to it. It could have some other measure. It's a token. If it's in one of these blockchain platform things, it's like I've got so many tokens. And depending on which application it is, that token has a different value that may or may not float in a different way.
Cryptocurrencies, I think, are going to be about tokenizing various assets. It's about, you know, in some cases, it's about securitizing various assets, but in others, it's not going to be a security, but it's going to be a token of some kind that might give you access to a network or represent an IOU or anything really. Right?
Once you get it in your mind, what it is. What it is. You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn. My guest today is Shadan Gouran. He is the president of Global Blockchain Technologies based in Toronto, Canada. So you're a Canadian firm.
That's right.
And you're traded on the Canadian Stock Exchange. But you're also listed in the U.S. and you're also listed in Europe. And how does that all work?
Yeah, we're one of the very few private equity firms, investment firms in the blockchain space. We act as an incubator to early ventures in the space. And one of our most recent projects was cryptocurrency mining, which we're actually spinning out into its own public company. We just did
that.
What is
mining?
Right. So mining is the act of verifying transactions. Miners are essentially the verifiers that a cryptocurrency transaction has occurred, and they get rewarded for that. And the whole point is you have thousands of people who are incentivized to verify these transactions because they will get rewarded a certain number of tokens for having, you know, seen that a transaction went through or didn't or was, you know, proper or, you know, invalid.
Well, think of the gold rush. All the 49ers landed in San Francisco, got their pickaxe, they got, you know, their sourdough starter, they got all of that, headed for the gold country. And when they did get gold, they had to bring it into the assay office, who didn't just weigh it, but had to grade it and try to figure out what, you know, what were the values and is this real? And it was a secondary part that said, okay, we're going to keep it and make sure it gets down to San Francisco. But the important part is they turned around and gave them a chit that says it's worth this much and it contains this much.
Exactly.
If blockchain had been around that day, they would have gotten so many tokens on the blockchain for this and so many tokens on the blockchain for that, and then gone into the saloon where they could use the tokens to buy a beer. Or whatever they bought. I don't know. What did they buy? What did the miners buy? Whatever they would
like. Whiskey and beer, I guess.
And beer. Yeah. So it's the same thing. Yeah. There was a lot of little pieces of paper and ledgers, and it's the same thing.
It's the same thing, yeah. It doesn't change any of the processes. It just makes it much more efficient, much more trustworthy than they were in the past.
Now, you're doing something else, which I think people can relate to. If you have transferred money internationally lately, one of the first things they ask you for is, hey, what's the SWIFT code of your bank? And what's the SWIFT code of the bank you're going to send it to? And we were so used to, what's your account number and what's the street address and all that stuff. But it's like, what's your SWIFT code? A SWIFT code makes things work really well today. Explain what that is.
So SWIFT is a common language, a general, global language for foreign exchange, for transferring money from, you know, one bank to another. And it's really what makes possible that you can transfer, you know, money from London, England to New York, for example, through a American bank.
And pretty quickly.
Fairly quickly, although blockchains will make that a lot faster. We're having a real problem in the cryptocurrency world right now that you're getting so many different cryptocurrencies, tokens based on blockchain technologies. And the problem is that all of these speak a different language. So, you know, if you end up in a world where Amazon has its own cryptocurrency, Microsoft has its own cryptocurrency, let's say Facebook has its own, then you have a community one like Bitcoin. These are all slightly different technologies at the end of the day, and they're not interoperable. So you're kind of where the computer networking was in the 90s. You have all these different protocols, all these different systems, and they don't know how to communicate with each other. What our technology, which we're calling the laser protocol, does, the laser network, it allows different cryptocurrencies to talk to each other and for you to be able to transact from one cryptocurrency to another. If you have Bitcoin and I have Ethereum, I will be able to send you my Ethereum in exchange for your Bitcoin.
And so you can send me the Ethereum and it converts to Bitcoin.
Yeah.
I can send you my Bitcoin and it converts to Ethereum.
Exactly.
Unless you want the Bitcoin.
You
might want the Bitcoin. But at any rate, you've created a system here whereby it's like the SWIFT system in traditional currencies, only it has to do with the cryptocurrencies. That's pretty slick.
It is, yeah. And you know, systems like this exist today that are centralized. There's exchanges for cryptocurrencies. You know, I can send, you know, one type of currency and it will send it to another person as a different kind of currency and do the automated exchange. Here we're doing this, again, in a decentralized fashion. This whole network does it in a trustless and decentralized fashion, kind of connects all these different cryptocurrencies together. And that's going to be, I think, a real key service that will be required in the future.
So you don't have to go to some centralized place to make the exchange.
Exactly. No centralized place. It all happens decentralized.
And the slowest way to do it is to convert your current cryptocurrency into, say, U.S. dollars. And then you take the U.S. dollars and buy the Ethereum and then hand you those. So
exactly.
You want to be able to just do all this thing, all the trading, just like we do currency trading today.
Exactly. It's all negotiated and done on the blockchain, and that's the real benefit of it.
Now, let's see, where do I want to go from here? Okay, so you talked about, you said there's a lot of currencies and there are going to be a lot more cryptocurrencies. Let's say I want to start a new cryptocurrency, the Moira coin. You like it?
I
think it's probably available. I don't know why. It's two OIs in the same word, so no one will ever be able to spell it. So we'll have to change the name. But let's say we have a Moira coin.
I think it's going to do really well just because it rhymes, if nothing else.
There you go. So the Moira coin, I say, gee, this is really good. I want to start up this currency. How would I start that up?
That's a great point you bring up. So cryptocurrencies open up a whole world of new financing for people and can actually displace the current model of private equity.
I've been speaking with Shadan Garan, the president of Global Blockchain Technologies. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of TechNation and TechNation Health are available at NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on TechNation Health, a technology that looks to improve the effectiveness of many existing medications, starting with osteoarthritis and liver cancer. And Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft looks at how global tech firms are jumping into healthcare. Stay with us. You're listening to Tech Nation. I've been speaking with Shadan Garan, the president of Global Blockchain Technologies, headquartered in Toronto, Canada. Let's say I want to start a new cryptocurrency, the Moira coin. How would I start that up?
That's a great point you bring up. So cryptocurrencies open up a whole world of new financing for people and can actually displace the current model of private equity. Because let's say, you know, you as Moira want to start your, you know, a new radio show and you know, with all your past accomplishments, you start a crowdfunding campaign that says, you know, I'm starting a radio show and I'm going to give out equity for this and I'm going to do it as a cryptocurrency. The cryptocurrency will represent equity in my new show.
I say, okay, a Moira coin costs $10.
Yeah.
And so you could, for every $10 you give me, I give you a Moira coin.
Yeah.
So I take my Moira coin or sets of Moira coin and I go through the laser network that mm-hmm. you guys have developed and I say, give me it in Bitcoin and you're able to do it.
Exactly. Yeah.
And what I really like is the idea that there's a Midwest silo coin that is in corn.
Yeah.
So you could convert it all to corn. I'm very happy about this.
Yeah.
This is, you really have to wrap your mind around the fact that currencies always and forever are exchanges of values with sort of numbers on them. You
exactly.
know?
And this is exactly why so much money is poured into the space and so many, you know, of the financial world is really investing in this technology, the technologies of cryptocurrencies, because it can allow things like the Moira coin to exist and completely revolutionize the private markets.
Now, to buy a Bitcoin today, and I checked this morning, would cost you $8,091. And and earlier this year, it approached $20,000 for a brief moment. And year before last, it was $350. You know, so we know that it goes up and down. Now, my question is, if you have a dollar bill, for instance, we're always talking U.S. dollars, we have things like quarters and dimes. Mm-hmm. Can you buy a portion of a Bitcoin or you got to buy the whole Bitcoin?
Oh, you can buy a portion of a Bitcoin. It's you know, one Bitcoin you can has 8 decimal places. So you can you know.
Ooh, not just two.
Yeah.
Not just a 1 to 100 cents.
Exactly.
You have 8 decimal
places.
Yeah,
there's cryptocurrencies that have 16 decimal places. There's
right down to the kernel of corn.
Exactly. Exactly. You could have, you know, a cryptocurrency that represents a kernel of a coin as its, you know, smallest decimal place, for example.
While I'm being extremely enthusiastic about this SWIFT code equivalent in cryptocurrencies, if you are moving large sums of money, and that would be anything over $10,000 internationally or even within the U.S., the international banking system wants to know about it. That's not the case with these global cryptocurrencies, right?
No, there is no regulation, and you're absolutely right about that. And regulators really have to catch up to the space. And there are issues around that. I mean, we you know, this technology can be used both for good and for bad. I mean, there is anonymity in the space. These tokens can be sent to anybody very easily, and they span borders. They can't really be censored. That was why Bitcoin was created, because it was, you know, you can't censor it. That's what the technology really brings. So regulations really do have to be put in place, and I think most people in the industry are for that. And at the same time, not so much so that it stifles the innovation in the space as well. It has to be done really properly, and I think there is a need for a wait and see period to really understand the space better before we make decisions too quickly at this point.
I think that's a good lesson that we're really learning today with the Facebooks and the social networks that have been invaded. It's like we were really at serial number one with wide use. And it's not just a question of policy. It's a question, well, how would we design it? And what would be the features and the benefits be if we designed it particular ways?
Yeah. And I mean, Facebook is a great example. I mean, there you're absolutely right. If we'd started off, you know, a decade and a half ago, worrying about, you know, let's first figure out privacy. We would have never built anything to actually test it. These systems are social systems, are very complex. It's better to start them and learn from them as we go along and what needs to be done. So right now there's a, you know, I think a real push to maybe overregulate the space. And I think probably a better approach is to really study it, learn it, and then make our decision on exactly how to really make it a benefit to society.
Give technology a chance to solve the problem.
Exactly.
It's supposed to legislate it or regulate it out the door.
Exactly. And I think in the 90s, we saw that with the internet. The government was very supportive in keeping it open and not overregulating it and actually giving great tax benefits and whatnot to businesses on the internet. And I think we should treat this space in the same vein, really. Keep it open and keep a very watchful eye on it. And once when we figure it out, I'm sure we'll make the right decisions.
Now, one last question. Your background is in math and theoretical physics. Is that what is required to work on blockchain?
No. It's actually
that,
not.
I'm kidding you,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Actually, this is a great point. You do have right now, I think, some of the best developers in the world focused on the blockchain space. It's not because blockchains are inherently more difficult. It's just that right now the people that are learning about it aren't learning about it because they're looking for jobs. They're learning about it because they're curious people by nature. They're interested in the technology and the potentials it has for the future. It's no different than people who got into computer graphics when I was like maybe a teenager or people who got into the internet in the 90s, right? Learning how to program websites and whatnot. And it really follows the same path. You always have the best developers who look at these technologies first because they're doing it out of interest and curiosity, not so much just finding a job, which is great. We have a wonderful roster of developers to choose from now, who are really good at what they do
all over the world.
Exactly.
Well, Shadan, thank you so much for joining us, and I hope you'll come back and see us again.
I really hope so, too, Moira. I really appreciated this. Yeah.
My guest today is Shadan Gouran, the president of Global Blockchain Technologies. More information is available on the web at globalblockchain.io. Not .com, but rather globalblockchain.io. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. Welcome to TechNation Health, reimagining the future of health and healthcare with the emergence of new technologies and breakthrough science. Medications are sometimes limited because we can't deliver the right dose to the right place, or we can't tolerate the size of the dose needed. We'll talk about a new technology that can serve many different conditions, including osteoarthritis and liver cancer. We'll also hear from TechNation Health Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft about how global tech firms are jumping into healthcare. George Ye is the president of TLC Bio in Taiwan, which focuses on global diseases of the aging. Given that there are 7.5 billion people in the world, how many people would be considered the aged?
I mean, if we look at the number today, over 65 years old, roughly about 10%, just a little bit over 10%. But remember, these numbers are growing at a speed. And I think we have to figure out a way to help to address these aging issues.
So 10%, we're talking 750 million.
Yes.
And because we have great medical care, better and better medical care,
yeah,
they're staying alive longer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be over a billion, I would guess, shortly.
Yeah, easily. I think probably in the next couple of years, we're going to see over a billion. And then this is globally facing this issue and how to address it. And with the healthcare system, how do we resolve that when people start living longer? And, you know, that's what TLC does, is we develop these type of unique proprietary technology to help to address issues such as osteoarthritis, such as age-related macular degeneration, eye disease. And these are all related to aging issue.
Now, you're technology is pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. As I recall, it's sort of a nanoparticle encapsulation of yeah. drugs. Why would we want to do that?
So I think one of the issues that we're addressing with some of the current treatment, let me give you an example, such as osteoarthritis. So you need to inject these, you know, to manage the pain.
So you might have it in your knee, you might have
yes.
it in your spine.
Joint
and so
spine,
you, and
yes.
so you usually inject things in there to relieve the pain?
Right. Usually you will inject steroids.
Steroids.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, that steroids have many side effects. And the physician sometimes do not recommend more than 3 to 4 injections per year because there's certain systematic effect, side effect that you will have. If you look at the current treatment of the steroid, pretty much you can manage the pain up to probably 2 weeks duration. So if you calculate the number, we're 3 to 4 injection a year, which come out to be, you know, the pain you need to manage a pain in a 3 to 4 months duration. But the current treatment is only 2 weeks. So how do you manage that, you know, from week 2 all the way to week, you know, 12 to 15?
Right.
And that's where our delivery system, our sustained release system, are able to use the existing drug and maximize its value and slowly release that to help you manage the pain.
Now, how does that work? It's the drug, the molecules of the drug are all the same size, and you've encapsulated this. How does it work that it can let some of them out over time?
So what we have develop is this multiple layer of lipid nanoparticle. Another easy way to look at it is if you take an image of it.
Sort of a slice of it.
Yeah, a slice of it. It's a little bit like the onion. So you see layer and layer of these lipid wrapping and trapping the drug. As the time release, and then you see layer of layer start to peel off. And then that's how we are able to manage these drugs at a very consistent level and then dose it.
I know you're also looking at the oncology area. Have you made progress there?
Yes, yes. So we have one that we just submitted for European approval. We're looking, you know, crossing our finger. We're looking to launch that. That's actually addressing for ovarian cancer as well as breast cancer. Another one that we are addressing is actually is currently in phase 2 right now, is for liver cancer. And because being based in Asia, liver cancer are a huge issue.
Much higher rates.
Yeah, I mean, roughly about 80 to 90% are liver cancer, actually, it's in Asia. And so we receive orphan drug status in the U.S. because, you know, there's not that many liver cancer. But being based in Asia, we do want to use our technology to help to address these issues.
Now, what would you be delivering with this nanoparticle encapsulation?
So a lot of these are existing drug that already work in certain disease cancer. And what we're doing is basically using our nanoparticle. One thing is to reduce the toxicity because the drug is being protected during the delivering process. A lot of toxicity that we have seen is really once you inject it, the drug just like go everywhere.
All over the system.
Yeah, and probably less than 1 to 2% will get to the target site. So you're leaving
That's part
about,
of why people get so ill.
Right, exactly. And a lot of time they're looking for a very narrow window between how much your body can take and how much we're addressing on the cancer. So a lot of times, hey, if you're able to push another further, you'll survive. It's because sometimes the body cannot uptake that much. And by using these nanoparticles, we're able to more efficiently deliver to the drug. And then the drug is being protected during the process where it will not damage these normal cells. And then you probably need lesser of drug to get to the target site, because originally you have 1 to 2% getting there. Now it's, 10, 15 times. So with lesser drug, you actually can still do the job.
So you're placing the cancer drug inside the nanoparticles,
yeah.
Sort of right next to the sites, like next
yes.
to the liver itself.
Yeah. Yeah.
So as that erodes,
yeah.
it's delivering the drug right there.
Yes, that's correct.
As opposed to through the blood or
yeah.
any other way of getting the drug.
Yeah, I think it's because when we design these nanoparticle, we design it like 80 to 100 nanometer. And then the nature of the tumor is, it's like growing rapidly. And as it grow into a tumor, the blood vessel near the tumor site, there's a lot of leakage. And then there are usually these leakage, clinically have shown roughly about 400 to 500 nanometer. So when you have 80 to 100 nanometer, so it's easier to permeate through. And then stay there.
And then not go through the veins because
exactly.
they're bigger than the veins.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's how
pretty clever, George.
Yeah, 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 yeah. That's how we deliver, efficiently deliver the drug. Because at the end, we know the drug work, but it's how can we maximize its value? Because if you are not able to maximize it, it might create other side effects, which is doing right now. So what we're doing is really maximizing the value of the drug itself.
George, thanks so much for coming in.
No, thank you. Thank you. It's good to see you again.
George Ye is the president of TLC Bio in Taiwan. More information is available from tlcbio.com. I've noticed for a while now that major tech firms all seem to have life science divisions, and that means healthcare. TechNation Health Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft.
Well, healthcare is a $3 trillion industry in the United States, and there's so many unmet needs. We're spending $3 trillion, but we're like 14th or 15th in outcomes. Our average life expectancy has been dropping the last couple of years due to, let's say, the opioid epidemic. So it is a time, given all the challenges of healthcare for some of these larger players, the Googles, the Amazons, the Apples, to potentially play a role, given that we touch and interact with those sorts of platforms sometimes thousands of times a day.
Okay, so who's doing what?
Well, we've just seen here in 2018 already several pretty major moves by, let's say, two of the big ones, Apple and Amazon. Let's start with Amazon. About half of the U.S. households have Amazon Prime. We've used that to change our buying habits. It recommends certain things for us. It has automatic refill buttons. It's nice to see things delivered to our doorstep sometimes where I live within the day. And Amazon is great at supply chain and customer experience. And they're now recognizing that the customer experience for healthcare often is limited and are moving, number one, into the pharmacy space, have become licensees, as I understand, in several states of pharmacy licenses. That may be very disruptive to the CVSs and the Walgreens and the Walmarts out there, where you may be literally able to order your prescription meds through Amazon and have it delivered to your doorstep. That's one element they're looking at. They've also been making inroads across how do you pay for healthcare. They did a partnership with J.P. Morgan and Berkshire Hathaway, and combining with Amazon, it's at 1.2 million workers to potentially retool how they pay for and manage their employee healthcare systems. And because 1.2 million is not a large fraction of the population, but the Amazons of the world and the JP Morgans and the Berkshire Hathaways certainly understand finances and incentives. And the potential there is to realign incentives, whether it's cutting out the middleman in the pharmacy benefit world called PBMs, or streamlining how you interface with your healthcare data and how we get that delivered and how we align incentives, not just for the providers, the doctors, the hospitals, but for the individual employees to stay on top of their health, to incentivize proactive prevention rather than the sick care side of the equation. That's part of what Amazon seems to be doing. And they also have some new technologies. 2 years ago, I got my first Amazon Alexa. We've seen things like the Google Home rollout, and Apple has a voice device as well. These voice devices can play certainly a huge role in health and medicine, all the way from Alexa, help, I've fallen, I can't get up, call 911, or hey, Google, make a doctor's appointment for me. Or Alexa, how many calories did I just eat? How much insulin should I take based on my connected glucometer? Connecting the dots, being a healthcare coach, all the way to being used in operating rooms to help manage checklists or to listen to your cough and maybe determine whether it's turning into a real pneumonia. So some of these platforms, Amazon has been a big proponent and builder of the voice platforms, can have healthcare implications as well.
One of the things we've had all the way along is protection of our data. I think everybody's heard of HIPAA, H-I-P-A-A. It's about protecting the privacy, and correctly so, of our health data. These platforms, these devices, these apps, they can only get as good as the data we provide it. This is a whole new, I hesitate to say slippery slope, I'd rather say it's a whole new frontier.
Well, data is becoming the oil of the healthcare and biomedical industry. So while we want to be careful to protect our medical data, and hopefully each of us as individual consumers and patients owns our own data, there is the danger of not sharing it enough. And some of these well-meaning laws like HIPAA, which is a law that many of us love to hate, was designed decades ago and needs to be retooled because in some cases it's hindering our ability to share information. But I like to think about data as a way to really accelerate the future of health and medicine. Just like 10, 11 years ago, we got our first smartphones, we got our first sort of Google Maps, and now platforms like Waze. We're all sharing some private data, our speed and location, that helps us build a map of the traffic. We get something back for that. If we could start to connect the dots between our healthcare data, whether that's what meds we're on, what conditions, what our family histories may be, we can build better healthcare maps. We can start to crowdsource those elements. But we want to be able to do that in a volunteer basis and in an anonymized, safe way. Where this is becoming really interesting and powerful is Apple, something many of us have in our pockets as a smartphone or in our homes as our computers, is moving into healthcare space. And the data side of this, they don't really want to make medical devices, but the iPads and the smartphones are becoming conduits for this information. And this last week, we're now at April of 2018, Apple opened up with combinations of 39 major hospitals from Stanford to Scripps to Duke, the ability to have your healthcare record live or be integrated into your smartphone data. So when I open up my health app on my phone, I can see my steps and my sleep from my connected watch.
I don't want that. Keep going. What else?
but now I can integrate my medical record from Stanford.
Okay. And I used to
log into that separately. It's a two-way street. Now my physician at Stanford can see my Apple HealthKit data from my glucometer, if I had one, to my steps, to my blood pressure, to my weight. That can integrate into a dashboard he can see. And as we start to combine these sort of data sets, our personal health records and our medical records, we're going to hopefully be able to build these smart anonymized and private maps that we can share across healthcare systems to be not doing 10-year-old data, but real-time intelligence-based information that can personalize care and give the information to each of us as an individual, but also provide that to our healthcare provider in a seamless way. We've all experienced that issue where we're trying to get a medical record potentially, and you have to call and fax in some form with your signature, and it's difficult to own our medical data. Platforms like the ones that Apple is opening up, I think, are an important conduit to connecting those dots.
Well, we always say, if nothing's wrong with me, I want my data. You know, just stay away from it. And if something is, you can have all the data. Fix me. And we're in this world right now with a backdrop of 50 million Facebook profiles downloaded with lots of data in them. It's like, whoa, wait a minute. We never signed up for that. This is, in a sense, one of the biggest challenges we have today. And we're dealing with the kind of technology, the architecture for which came out of sort of last millennium. The fact that we could just do it was an amazing, amazing thing. But we're not really there now.
And sometimes there are unintended consequences. You know, we're in the era now of the $100 genome. We're in the era now where, yes, a lot of your health and other habits can be picked up from your wearable device on your wrist. And there's a power in keeping that safe and secure, but also a power and opportunity to become a data donor and share that information, just like we're used to becoming blood and sometimes organ donors. There's a lot of public benefit from that. The Facebook challenges that are in the news can potentially harm the incentives and the openness that society can have that can, again, catalyze smarter, more connected, proactive health and medicine, from using our digital exhaust to pick up disease early to managing disease, to doing clinical trials. A lot of these are now living on our smart devices. One example of how this can shift healthcare, I recently saw a presentation at the HIMSS meeting, the big healthcare IT meeting, where they talk about interoperability. And there's a group out of University of Virginia, pediatric cardiologists. I'm a pediatrician. We know that it's important to communicate not just with the child, but their parents. They work with children who had recently had heart surgeries, children born with a cardiac malformation, needed a heart surgery, had pretty complicated medication lists and follow-up. These parents were leaving the hospital maybe after a month or two with their relatively new child and normally going home with a binder. You know, they came from an intensive care unit or step-down unit, now coming home with a binder and so much to take care of. Now they have sort of, as we talked about in prior episodes, appified that. You have a tablet that has the medical list, helps you track symptoms, blood pressure, when did the child take their medication, did they have any side effects. When things were going out of the norm, let's say a high or too low blood pressure, that could be sent to the nursing team or the medical team to make an appropriate intervention. And by using these sort of now tablicized, appified health records to connect the patient and their families, they had much better outcomes and far less rehospitalizations of these very often sick and complicated patients when they left the hospital. So there's the potential to use these consumer devices, these increasingly lower cost tablets and smartphones and wearables to connect our data, to incentivize folks to take their blood pressure meds and improve the outcomes from controlled blood pressure, to understand their medication list, to be able to share their runs and their exercise data with their doctor, who may not ever want to look at that data, but hopefully can see when they're going out of range. And even knowing that your clinician can see that information can sometimes incentivize better behaviors and what we call medical adherence, to take your medications and stay on top of a medical regimen.
So in an earlier segment, we noticed you said appify. We went through that. Now I hear tablicize. Okay, how do you spell it, or do you know?
I don't think tablicize is yet in the Merriam-Webster Dictionary.
Tablet-sized, T-A-B-L-E-T-C-I-Z-E, maybe?
We can patent that.
Cards and letters coming in, email to us, you know, get us in the contact us form. Give us your best spelling for your suggestion, and we look forward to it. Thank you, Daniel.
Well, I'll just say in closing, we're in this incredible new mobile, tablicized, appified era. It can take what used to be reams of paper that you couldn't track, that were using faxes to communicate, and put that on your smartphone, on your watch, through your voice assistant on Amazon Echo, all these new ways to integrate this information, make it more personalized, more relevant, and more tuned, really can help shift healthcare and hopefully move our $3 trillion healthcare industry to $2 trillion with better outcomes and lower costs and better experiences for all of us across the healthcare continuum.
Better, faster, cheaper. Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thanks, Mara.
Dr. Daniel Kraft is the chief correspondent of TechNation Health and the founder and chair of Exponential Medicine. More information is available at exponentialmedicine.com. For TechNation Health, I'm Moira Gunn.
TechNation and its regular segment BiotechNation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. TechNation and BiotechNation are productions of TechNation Media. I'm Paul Landcore.